It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next on Central Time, we'll talk to a privacy and law expert who says it's time to turn the tables on social media companies and develop a people's terms of service.
First, President Obama is trekking to Europe this week to attend the 2014 NATO summit. Since the end of the Cold War, these summits have seemingly been searching for a new purpose for the alliance. Some of the attendees haven't always been shy about voicing their displeasure about being there.
But according to our next guest, this is the year that could change things. And with Russian President Vladimir Putin's push into Ukraine, the 65-year-old NATO finally has a mission.
Joining us now is George Condon. He's White House correspondent for the National Journal. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
So NATO founded in opposition to the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. Since the end of the Cold War, has there been kind of a question about what it's still there for?
Oh, they have spent all their summits since 1989, basically wither the Western alliance. You know, what is the future? What is the purpose? What's holding us together? And on this one, they actually don't have to answer that question. They sort of had it answered for them by Vladimir Putin.
So in absence of this this issue with Russia here, at 17 of these summits since the Berlin Wall came down, what have they talked about? What have they done? What's their mission been in absence of a mission?
Well, that's one of the things they've talked about is you sort of go back to the original meaning of the summit, which they shortened to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. And they said, well, we've achieved that, so let's talk about partnerships with Russia, NATO-Russia partnerships. Let's talk about out-of-theater operations, Afghanistan being the first one outside of Europe. That's what's engaged them.
So out of theater, meaning we've got nothing to do in Europe, so what else can we do around the rest of the world?
Exactly.
So, and you mentioned partnerships with Russia. Vladimir Putin had been invited to hang out at some past summits, not this time around.
No, that's true. He's attended some. He pointedly said he had to, I think it was, wash his hair when the Chicago summit was in 2012. He said he had to pick his cabinet, even though he wasn't the one picking the cabinet at the time. But this time, they don't have to play games like that because they didn't want him there and they didn't invite him.
So even leading up to the summit itself, President Obama is sending a message by his travel plans, you write. He's going via Estonia. Why?
Well, because the countries, especially the NATO members, who are most nervous about what are Russian intentions are the three Baltic states and Poland. And the president already carried his message to Poland with an earlier trip, and he needs to go to the Baltic states. And in Estonia, he'll meet with the other two Baltic leaders, Lithuania and Latvia. And what they want to hear is one thing, that Article 5 is ironclad. And Article 5 is the key article in the NATO charter, which basically says an attack on one member is regarded as an attack on all.
So that means that unlike Ukraine, not a NATO member, if there is Russian military intervention of any sort on any of these NATO countries, Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, for example, that's an attack on all NATO countries, and a military response would be expected from the U.S. and all the NATO partners.
Well, there's a little out there. It doesn't say you have to have a military response. It says you have to have a response. Now, it certainly, if you had Russian tanks moving and to lend, you would certainly see a military response. But imagine for a second if President George W. Bush had wanted to expand NATO to include Georgia and Ukraine. If he had had his way on that, we would have been required, and the other NATO members would have been required to respond in 2008 when Russia went into Georgia, and respond last year when Russia went into Crimea.
Well, flipping that around, though, if they were NATO members, would Russia have felt that freedom to act in the way they did in those places?
Well, that's an unanswerable question.
Sure.
What we do know is that Vladimir Putin feels really aggrieved by NATO. He blames NATO for all of his problems. And I am not sure that you'd want to stake everything on a bet that he would have been dissuaded, because he really wants to restore what he sees as the glory of the Soviet Union, and feels a special kinship with Ukraine, which they blame Nikita Khrushchev for basically giving away when he was head of the Soviet Union. So I wouldn't have taken that bet that he wouldn't have acted.
And Putin is aggrieved by NATO's very conscious effort to expand eastward, their drive to the east. In a way, he wasn't pleased that NATO wanted to get countries that he regarded in his, to use the 19th century term, a sphere of influence.
Exactly. I mean, he was not happy when Poland became a member. He certainly was not happy when the three Baltic states came in. There was less unhappiness about Hungary, but it was still there. I mean, they basically see NATO as an anti-Russian organization and do not like, and especially now that there's talk that Finland is considering applying for NATO. I mean, that really would drive them crazy.
Well, looking at options on the table as NATO meets this week and focuses largely on Russia and the situation in Ukraine, the latest news there, there are members of the Russian military, or at least past members, getting captured in Ukraine. Russia denying that they're actively involved in Ukraine. Ukraine saying no, they're armored units, they're infantry units of the Russian army in Ukraine. What can NATO do that hasn't already been done in terms of sanctions?
Well, number one, you can ratchet up the sanctions and make them even more painful. This is not like before 1989. I mean, Russia's economy is integrated with the West and with the rest of the world. And whereas sanctions during the Cold War probably wouldn't have had much impact, it is having an impact. If you look at the value of the ruble, or you look at the contraction of the GDP, it is hurting them. And at some point, we haven't reached that point, Putin will not want to absorb that. The second thing that they're talking about doing is what they're calling a rapid reaction force, where you would have like 4,000 troops that would be able to move on 8 hours' notice and deploy quickly into Eastern Europe. And that's something they're probably going to agree on in Wales.
Well, as things have deteriorated here, I've seen some mentions of, we're in the equivalent of a new Cold War. Is that an exaggeration, or is there something to that?
It's an exaggeration. I mean, we're not going back to a Warsaw Pact against NATO and ICP, and realistic fears of ICBM striking. But when you are dealing with two countries with nuclear forces, you do have to tread carefully. But I would not go so far as to say another Cold War. There was a lot more involved than that.
George, before I let you go, do you think there's going to be relative harmony among NATO members, relative agreement in how to deal with Russia at this meeting this week?
Well, now that one of the problems in NATO being so big now, for an alliance that operates on consensus, having 28 members, it is more difficult. They're certainly going to fight again over, our desire that all NATO members spend at least 2% of GDP on defense, because only four of the NATO members right now are meeting that, and the United States does not want to keep, bankrolling the entire alliance along with Britain. You have countries like Hungary, surprisingly, that thinks the sanctions are too strict, and then you balance that with Poland and the Baltics, who want them stronger. So I think they will come up with something, but the consensus isn't quite as easy as it used to be.
George, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, glad to.
That was George Condon. He's White House correspondent for the National Journal. He just wrote the piece there, "As Obama Heads to Summit, NATO Finds Renewed Purpose."
If you're a Facebook user, some of the company's actions may have rubbed you the wrong way over the past few months, from letting marketers track you around the web to experimenting on your news feeds without your consent. Some users are feeling exasperated. But what if there was a way to get Facebook and other social media sites to agree to terms set by users?
Our next guest says instead of those social media sites presenting us with 30 plus pages of terms of service that we agree to, it's time to flip the equation around and develop a people's terms of service agreement that the sites would have to agree to. He says it would be a common reference point, a stamp of approval, kind of like a fair trade label for the web to govern the next photo-sharing app or responsible social network.
Joining us now to talk about that idea is Woodrow Hartzog. He's an assistant professor at the Cumberland School of Law at Samford University. Woodrow, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
So what sorts of gains have we seen or sense that awareness is changing regarding the way people regard these current terms of service set by social media sites?
Well, the nice thing that we see is a dialogue happening when we feel like social media stepped over the boundaries, right? So we see a lot of news articles that come out and they say Facebook is monkeying with your feed, and you see a certain amount of outrage. Of course, perhaps ironically, a lot of that outrage is expressed on social media, but of course, it only underscores the utility of social media, and that it's a very useful place for us to go and kind of air grievances among everyone else. And so with that, we actually see a sort of consensus forming about what some norms are around what intermediaries are allowed to do on social media with the information that we're actually providing to them.
Now, right now, if you want a Facebook account, you go online, you have to click agree to their terms of service, but generally nobody reads it because there's so much of it and you probably wouldn't understand it anyway. But would you say that it's fair to say that right now it's just giving these social media sites carte blanche to you take cherry pick what they want to do with your data and do it?
Well, it's pretty close to that. So we know several things about this. A, you're right, nobody reads them. And it actually makes sense to not read them, because if you decided, you know, that you were going to read all of the terms of use that you encountered in any one given day, you wouldn't do anything else but read terms of use online. So you would wake up at 6 in the morning and say, all right, I got a long day of reading social media terms of use ahead of me. And so it's not rational even to expect that you read them. But the unfortunate thing is that courts actually do enforce these agreements. So when you click, I agree, then courts have pretty uniformly said that that's a binding contract. And so what we know is that, of course, these agreements are written so that intermediaries, social media, can limit risk. They draft them in favor of the social media. There are very permissive terms that allow social media to do lots of different things. And so in the instance of the Facebook experimentation feed, one thing that we saw was that there was a permission to use information contributed by users for research purposes, right? And that's a very broadly worded statement. And of course, it's in the intermediary's interest to have very broadly worded statements like that and like other things, so that it has permission, because what these terms of use function as are consent agents, right? So this is a way of getting consent to do all kinds of different things. And that's really problematic, because, of course, it runs contrary not only to expectations that we had before we even signed up, but sometimes it actually runs contrary to our experience on the website. So, for example, when you have certain representations that are made either by the design of the website, so things like use your privacy settings to control who sees your information, and somebody else actually sees that information, then that actually probably runs contrary to your legitimate expectations of things like privacy.
Now, you've got an idea for people to try to reclaim some legal power when it comes to these terms of service. You're calling it the People's Terms of Service as a starting idea. How did that idea come about?
Well, so my co-authors and I were very frustrated a little while back about the inability for users to negotiate any kinds of favorable terms when signing up for these services. So these terms are often called contracts of adhesion, and they're adhesive because, of course, you can't negotiate them. So if try calling up Facebook and saying, Facebook, I don't really like this one term that you had in here. Is there any way that we can negotiate this? That's kind of a laughable proposition. And, of course, Facebook would say you either take the terms as we present them or you walk away. And so we began to get frustrated because the only option it felt like users had were to say yes to whatever these companies were willing to give you. And so one of the things that we wanted to explore was a way to fight back. And we quickly began to realize that one person in isolation is not going to make much of a difference, right? So many people said, well, if you don't like using Facebook so much, then why don't you just leave? And of course, that's one way to handle the problem. But one of the big problems that we know with social media is that nobody wants to go where nobody else is, right? So you want to stay where your friends are. And so unless all of your friends simultaneously got up and decided to move to the exact same other service, then it's difficult to leave. And of course, the other option is staying remotely offline. And there are options for that, too. But social media is actually useful, and many people get a great value out of it. So one of the things we wanted to try to find was some kind of way in which users could have a say in how their information was treated and how they were to be treated when using an online tool like social media. And so one of the things that we realize is that while consumers are not necessarily powerful individually, they're immensely powerful together. And if a movement could be formed where we actually all got together and demanded some kind of adherence to a common code, right? So some kind of reference point where we could say, do you adhere to something like the People's Terms of Service? And they don't have to be complicated. They can really just be a set of five or six different very basic principles.
Right. And you say if you get this critical mass of people in the piece, you say maybe 3 million would be enough to get you going. What are some five or six starting points that people should look at to sort of start that people's term of service?
Sure. Well, there, of course, everyone has different preferences, which is, of course, the beauty of contracting. But we think that there are at least four or five things that most social media users could agree on. One of them is permanency, right? So if you promise me something, then you should probably keep it the same, so don't go changing the terms. One of the reasons that I think people get really frustrated and upset with social media companies is they seem to change the rules of the game midstream, right? So now you have to have certain kinds of leeway for social media to be able to change the rules, but when they do so unexpectedly and don't give you adequate notice, then that becomes really problematic. The second thing is transparency. How are these decisions being made? How does Facebook determine what is presented in our newsfeed? How do we know how our information is being used? So transparency is going to be a key component to provide meaningful notice to users. One of the things that, if you'll recall, I think it was last year or maybe a little more than a year ago, when Instagram changed their terms of service, a lot of people thought that their intellectual property rights were being infringed because there were some terms in there about the way that Instagram would use the photos and people within the photos for certain purposes. And so one of the things that we think companies should do is make a commitment to respect the value of an individual's name or likeness and the copyrights of their information. So don't take more licenses than you need to use personal information. One of the things that we think should be a bedrock protection is confidentiality. If you promise things like privacy settings and that no one else will see your information, then you really must stick to that promise. And that's something that users want, I think, more than anything. And so one of the biggest misconceptions about privacy and social media is that if you post something online, then surely you can't expect it to be private. And I don't think that's true at all. I think that there are lots of different ways that we can think about privacy, and one of them is confidentiality, that you can share information with some people but without sharing it to all people. And then the final thing, and one that I think is increasingly salient, even increasingly more salient, even from when we proposed this a little while back, is data security. We think companies should promise reasonable data security measures because that's only becoming a bigger issue. And now that we've seen with some high-profile data breaches that we've had recently, data security isn't just for financial information anymore, that because we store some of our most intimate moments online, that it's also important for social media as well.
And in our last 30 seconds here, Woodrow, if people are interested in this, and even if they're pessimistic that these corporations will actually take action, what can people do to start the conversation?
People can, let their voices be heard to social media themselves, so you can write emails. There's a conversation always going. And, B, use this kind of language among your friends, right? Say, if we don't like this, let's talk about this. Let's be vocal about our demands, because if we remain quiet, then nothing will change. And so just starting the conversation is the most important step at this point.
Well, Woodrow, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Woodrow Hartzog, an assistant professor at Cumberland School of Law at Samford University. We've been talking about his call for a people's terms of service for social media.
Sometimes it's hard to know how to be a friend to someone who's depressed. While someone who suffers from clinical depression might need professional help, family and friends can make a big difference in a lot of cases. But what's the right way to reach out?
Relationship expert Elizabeth Bernstein looked into the topic for her latest column, and she's here to share what she learned. Elizabeth Bernstein is a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, where she writes the Bonds on Relationships column. You can find a link to her latest on the Central Time Facebook page. Elizabeth, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So how did this topic come about? What made you think about it?
Well, it's a topic that I had been wondering for a long time. Whenever I've seen somebody hurting, when I myself have been sort of in pain, how can I let people help me? I started to think a little more about it when Robin Williams died, and thought, you know, there were a lot of celebrities out there saying, you know, I knew him for decades. He was a good friend. I had no idea. And I thought, well, you know, how do we know then if a loved one's hurting? And then I had a friend recently say to me, you know, I'm really hurting. In fact, he's a veteran, checked himself into the VA PTSD program and sort of signaled, and I was at a loss. How do I help these people? How do you help someone you care about? You can say, I'll be there. You can call me. You know, we can get together. Everybody nods and says yes, but that's not really effective help. So I wanted to do the research really for myself to find out.
Well, I think a starting point for a lot of people, I'll include myself in this, is I don't know what to say. I know I don't want to make things worse. So in the end, we're just kind of paralyzed and don't say anything.
We don't say anything. And so this is, you know, we're talking about how do you help somebody who's depressed? How do you help somebody who's grieving, who's bereaved because they've lost a loved one? You know, and many times we do exactly that. We don't know what to say, so we don't say anything. We're very worried we're going to say something wrong. Or we come up with platitudes. We say, oh, time heals all wounds. You have a lot to live for. Why are you so down? That kind of thing. Those are not helpful to somebody who's seriously struggling emotionally.
And as part of the problem here is that there's not really a one-size-fits-all approach to depression. We have to tailor it to the people, use common sense, and kind of feel our way, even though there may be general guidelines.
Exactly. So, you know, somebody may be very depressed or, you know, they may have lost a job or, you know, had a breakup with, you know, a loved one and be depressed. But there's something different. There's clinical depression. They may be very, very seriously ill, have a chemical problem in their brain that is causing them a depression. Somebody who is bereaved because of a death is, that's a different situation. They might not have that chemical imbalance and be clinically depressed. But they can be very down. So all of these things you do have to sort out. How do I, you know, how do I talk to this person? How do I offer help? But then even so, there's sort of, you know, ways to step up that are the same.
Well, and you mentioned a couple of the don'ts, and it seems like maybe one guideline, and in reading some of the work you did on this, one key is to not, I guess, put the blame on the person doing the suffering, not to say what's wrong with you or you're suffering wrong, in effect. How can we avoid that pratfall?
Exactly. It goes back to that phrase, you know, oh, come on, you've got everything to live for. You have beautiful children, beautiful wife, you know, great job. What's wrong with you? Well, you're really just saying, like, hey, you know, something is wrong with you, and the person's already worried, you know, why do I feel this way? You can't ever really understand somebody's, like, psychic wounds, but we can be there. So the opposite of that, of saying, you know, what's wrong with you, would be to say, how are you? Which is really the first opening line, you know, we should use for any of these situations. How are you? Ask the person, how are you really? Are you okay? Again, you don't want to say, you know, because I've noticed you look horrible. You don't want to say that, you know. But you want to say, you know, are you okay? You know, and then listen to the answer. Don't just keep talking over it.
And what happens when you get that answer? Sometimes that's the difficult thing. If someone really is honest with you and opens up and shares their vulnerability and their pain, it's that follow-up that can trip us up sometimes. So what is the right way to move forward at that point?
So you want to, first of all, you only want to really be asking if you want to follow up, if you feel like you're capable of the follow up. If you're not, you may see somebody hurting, say a coworker really hurting, you don't feel like you are capable, you don't have the time, or you don't know the person well enough to follow up. You can direct someone else to that. You can, you know, go to somebody who does know that person better and say, hey, I'm worried about Jim, why don't we, you know, maybe you should do something. But the follow up, you're right, is very hard. So you will listen to what they're saying and then ask them, hey, how can I help you? What can I do? I can listen if you want to talk more. I could distract you. Do you want to go out shopping? Do you want to go out biking? Anything, you know, whatever you do. You want to go out hunting? Whatever it is, you know, I can take your mind off of this. I can just come over and be with you and be quiet. But you want to ask them what kind of help they need. Would it help if I checked in with you? How? Would it help if I checked in with you on the phone? Would it help if I checked in with you via text? So you don't really have to talk if you don't want to. The follow-up question is to ask how to help.
And then once you get that answer, how to help, how do you then take that forward? How do you make sure you are in the right place, helping enough, not badgering the person who may not, you know, may not want your help all the time? Where do you take it then?
Exactly. Again, you could just keep asking. But, you know, a good sort of rule would be to be an active friend. So, you know, to send text, hey, I'm thinking about you. I have a friend who lost his wife this summer, very unexpectedly. And, you know, I send a lot of texts. You know, hey, I'm thinking of you. How are you doing? You know, we're both scuba divers. Do you want to go out and dive sometime? And I'm not offended that he doesn't want to, but he says, hey, I appreciate the text. And he told me recently, actually for this article, I talked to him, and he said, you know, that's what I love. Texts from friends that say they're thinking about me. I know I'm not alone. I know I have people reaching out to me. I could be with them if they want, but I don't have to talk about what's really hurting. So you want to be that active friend, send the invites. I would err a little bit more on the side of being engaged than not engaged. I think that the problem, you know, where we lose people like Robin Williams is, you know, maybe people are not engaged enough.
And I want to bring a caller in on this. And by the way, you can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you like to reach out to people when you find out they're struggling, that they're depressed? And what do you need from people in return? What does work? What doesn't work? We're going to go now to Anna in Harbor Springs, Michigan. Hi, Anna.
Hello. I have experienced chronic depression for many years, most of my adult life, and I find that a couple of things, the things that you're saying are also very helpful. There are a couple other things. One is for the people, the friends, to relax and not be afraid of the depression and just let the person be. You know, whether you're talking to them or not, if you do ask them questions and they do respond, then of course, you know, you listen, you let them know that you're listening, but relax about it. And the other thing is to not assume that they don't want to go out and do fun things. Those things can be a really good distraction when somebody really needs distraction.
Okay, thank you, Anna. Those are some very good points you made there. And one, her first point is to relax around people. I guess the takeaway here is that a lot of people might get kind of worried or tense when they're working with or talking with a person who's depressed, and so they're not maybe at their best or able to be their best selves if they're tense. What do you think about that, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I agree. So many people probably are very nervous around this. Depression is very frightening. We worry about what's happening to that person. If you haven't been depressed before, you don't fully understand what's happening in their mind. If you have, it's frightening because you know you could go there too. So all of it is frightening. We don't want to do the wrong thing. We're worried this will happen to us someday. All of it's frankly pretty terrified. So you have to relax and just say, hey, come with us. We're going to dinner. You know, I know you're not feeling great. We would love to have you there. You don't have to be yourself. You don't have to be funny and talk and just come out, enjoy everybody's company. I'll pick you up and drive you. That kind of thing. You know, I don't, we don't expect you. Let them know. We don't, you know, we understand. We don't expect you to, you know, have to step up and be super social. Just come with us and be there. Just be where you are right now. Be around us, though.
Well, and from what Anna said about going out and doing fun stuff and what you said, Elizabeth, about, hey, let's go scuba diving together, we can relax some of the expectations on ourselves. We don't have to be a brilliant therapist to help a friend through depression. We don't have to interact with the depression part. We can do the fun stuff with them and help take their mind off.
Exactly. I mean, I can think back to a time when I was depressed. My sister took me hiking. I'm not a hiker. And marched me to this mountain in North Carolina. And she sang. And then on the way back, she put on some country music. And we just had a great time. And I thought, you know, I don't feel great today, but I see I'm going to feel great in the future. You know, like I could see the end of the tunnel by that. And so I think there's that. You don't have to, if you're depressed, love every moment. But that's what we as people helping don't have to be so scared of it. Just bring them out. Like stay connected. Don't, people who are depressed isolate themselves. That is one of the symptoms. It's one of the huge problems. And so if you can sort of help that in any way, that's great. Just, you know, hey, stop by, brought you some bread I baked, that's it, don't need to talk, anything like that I think is fine.
Well, this is maybe a dumb worry, but I'd be worried about, do I want to be all happy in front of a person who's dealing with this unhappy situation? Is that, you know, flaunting it in their face?
Well, you know, I think that is, you know, a strong worry that anybody would have. And, you know, you'd have, of course, see if your friend is crying away and, you know, really quite devastated trying to talk to you. Yes, cracking jokes is probably not a good idea. But on the other hand, think about, I'm sure we've all been in situations where maybe we've lost a loved one or we've been at a funeral and somebody will even say something funny about the person who's passed away. And people laugh. They want to remember the good times. You know, we're human and that pull towards the light is also very strong. Again, I don't think you have to not be yourself. You just have to sort of, as we were saying in the beginning, feel your friend out. Yeah, you don't want to be, you know, a clown if they're really, really hurting, but, you know, trying to get them to laugh if you feel like that might help is a good thing.
We're talking to relationship expert Elizabeth Bernstein about how to be a friend to someone who's grieving or someone who's depressed.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. What do you do to support or comfort your loved ones when they're down? And how do you help a depressed friend or family member? What do you look for in others when you're feeling down? And what do you wish people would just not do when you're down? 800-642-1234 is our number. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. We're picking up our conversation with relationship expert Elizabeth Bernstein about how to be a friend to someone who's suffering from depression.
And you can join the conversation. How do you treat your friends? How do you try to help people you know when they're feeling down? Maybe they're grieving. What kind of support do you look for from your friends when you're having a hard time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
And we'll go now to your calls. Kathy is first from Appleton. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi, what are you like when you're feeling down?
Well, what I've done for a friend of mine was just seasonal depression. And what we've done before is get together and I'd say, well, I'll help you clean. Like, we'd do it together at her house because when people are depressed, they have a hard time getting the motivation maybe to clean or do their errands. And I would do that with her, and she would be like, okay, but then I'm going to help you tomorrow, you know, so she didn't feel like, you know, like I was doing something too much for her.
Okay.
And And then, so then it just seemed to cheer her up because we would have fun doing it. And it would take a load off of her because, you know, whatever it was that was bothering her, either her housework or her errands or even paying, writing out her bills, or going through things in the basement, you know, whatever it was that we did, it just took that load off of her because she didn't have the motivation to get started by herself.
All right. Thank you, Kathy. Those are some great ideas there. And something that Kathy's doing that you mentioned, Elizabeth, is also doing something concrete, reaching out, but also saying, here's what I'm doing for you. So it doesn't have to be sort of an amorphous reaching out. She says, I'm going to come over and we're going to clean together. And it seems to help everybody.
Yeah, it's really great. And it's wonderful to remember that people who are depressed, they don't have that motivation. So, you know, depression zaps your energy. So, you know, they may not feel like, you know, cleaning or cooking or a lot of things. So saying, hey, yeah, I'm going to come over. Or, you know what, you probably could use an afternoon. I'll take the kids. Or, let me cook something for you and bring it over. It's really helpful. We do these things for people who are grieving a death. And so we don't think, I think we are more scared of depression and even more baffled by what to do. So sort of remember the same things, like we can help you concretely. Or, you know, I'm going to the store. I know, you know, you might have gone, but maybe you want to go to the grocery with me. It'd be fun to do it together. That kind of thing.
Thanks for that call, Kathy, at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth, you give a case in your piece of someone who is experiencing depression themselves and actually reached out and told people, hey, here's what I want from you. Here's how to talk to me, that kind of thing. Is that common? Is that something that is helpful for people in that situation to do?
I think it is helpful. I don't think it's that common that people think to do it. You know, when you're depressed, you're not thinking correctly or well anyway. You know, but this person was grieving somebody who had died and, you know, had his friend actually say to him, hey, you're not yourself. And he felt that on top of losing his friend who had died, he now had other friends talking about how he wasn't himself. He didn't look, you know, great. He wasn't happy. And so he felt offended on top of his loss. So he did. He wrote a letter to everybody and said, look, here's how you can help me. You can tell me you love me. You can invite me out. You can ask what I need from you. But, you know, that I imagine would be very helpful to hear. You know, here's how you can help me. But then you have to follow through. You have to, if somebody says to you, hey, here's how you can help me, you know, you can't just nod and go away. You got to follow up.
In terms of, you know, making those missteps when we're trying to help someone, do you think that it's better to just to try and maybe step in it once in a while, but to make that effort, is it better to bungle a little but make the effort than just to sit on the bench?
Yeah. You know, I think it's better to bungle it. And I don't think you can really bungle things too badly if you say, hey, how are you doing? Not the elevator talk, you know, oh, hey, how's it doing? Fine, thanks. You know, hey, how are you? Are you okay? And if somebody's really, really down, I think that there's important questions, follow-up questions. Are you safe? You know, have you ever thought of hurting yourself? Maybe that's a very shameful topic. People might not want to be honest about it, but if somebody is, or you get the sense that they are really might be suicidal, another question is, you know, do you have a plan? Because you're going to be able to, you know, get some type of sense of where they are and how far down the road, you know, you need to pull them back from. So, you know, but I just think, yeah, I think erring on the side of, in a little bit, I don't want to say pushy, if you don't somebody, but being a little bit eager to help is much better than just letting somebody suffer on their own.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Beth on the line in Madison. Beth, hi there.
Hi. My daughter was hospitalized with depression a couple times, suicidal in that, and I didn't know what to do, and my best thing I think I did was I said right to her, what can I do to help you? And that made her stop and think and kind of got a little smile on her face and said, you know, just knowing that you're willing to do anything is enough. And she did give me some, you know, things like, would you take me shopping? Would you go with me? Or something like that, you know. But it was just, I think, her knowing that I was willing to do whatever kind of set her more at ease.
Beth, thank you so much for sharing that story. Good luck to you and your daughter. Elizabeth, can it be just that simple?
Yeah, I actually think that that is the key. How can I help you? And letting that person know, again, depression is sort of a loss of hope. So a person who's depressed is going that sort of this rabbit hole where it gets darker and darker and there's no hope. And so understanding that someone is there, someone is willing to stop what they're doing and come over and help you, willing to do whatever it takes, is huge. It's huge. Even if the depressed person doesn't take you up on it right away, they might down the road, but it's huge. How can I help you is so key.
And let's get another caller now. Julia joins us in La Crosse. Hi, Julia.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I had a bout of major depression in my first few weeks of college, and I went to a college that was different from most of my friends in high school. And when I was going through this, I started reaching out to them, you know, trying to talk to them, and one of them actually told me to stop contacting her because I was being a bummer. And I just wanted to say, you know, if you know someone that's depressed that's trying to reach out to you, don't just abandon them. Find some other way to help them.
Okay, well, that's good advice. So did you find someone who was able to help you, or did you end up having to find other resources?
I ended up there. I met some amazing people at college that took way better care of me than, you know, the people that I'd known for 4 years. They would come to my dorm room, make sure that I was eating, and would just sometimes just come and sit with me. Like, we didn't have to talk or didn't have to do anything. We could just sit in the same room and do our homework. And that just, it really helped me know that I wasn't alone.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you, Julia, for sharing your experience. And, you know, that can be a painful thing when you're going through a painful time. If someone is not willing to be there for you and you do make that effort to reach out to them, Elizabeth, do you have any thoughts on that situation?
Yeah, I think that, again, that's very, very important. Sometimes the person doesn't want to talk, but, again, depression is isolating. So you just having somebody around to know, you know, hey, I'm not really alone, even if I can't rise to the occasion and even sort of chit-chat, is really helpful. That's why I also think that invitations to do activities where you might not have to talk, like, do you want to go biking? Do you want to go? I thought scuba diving was great. You don't have to talk at all. You can't talk underwater. You know, so, you know, do you want to just take a walk? But again, how can I help you? Can I just come over and do my homework with you? That's huge.
What if, though, there's a situation where it's like this person is in a bad position, the person they're asking for help realizes it's out of their ability to deal with? How do you get somebody toward maybe professional help if they need that in our last 30, 40 seconds or so?
So I think that's a very important question. You can ask them, hey, have you thought about professional help? You know, it's, it's certainly you want to be vulnerable too. If you've ever had professional help, if you've been down, something's helped you, great to share it. You know what? I've gone to a therapist. It's been great. But also, sometimes when people are depressed, they'll resist help. You want to reach out to other people around that person. If you feel you're in over your head, you want to reach out to somebody else who might be closer, more qualified, better equipped, and get them on the case too.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That's Elizabeth Bernstein. She's a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, where she writes the Bonds on Relationships column. With us to talk about her latest piece on how to be a friend to someone with depression, we've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page.